The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Thanks for joining us. This is a huge show. I've been looking forward to this one and talking about it for a few months, actually. I know we're planning this at Sibos and talking about this for a few months. You guys know it's been coming. So this is great. The question is New York or is London the global leader in fintech? Fintech is obviously exploding. This year we've seen a lot of activity for this. Of course, it's centered really particularly right now in New York and London. Silicon Valley was where a lot of this started. If you look at investments like Square, even PayPal and things like this, you could say these early fintech investments came out of Silicon Valley. But this year, of course, Silicon Alley in New York edged out Silicon Valley in terms of total investment in fintech, and that's a sizable milestone. But according to American Banker and research done by Accenture earlier in the year, London is now the biggest global center for fintech firms, beating out Silicon Valley and New York, based on number of people the industry employs. So what is the right measure of activity? Is it investment dollars? Is it number of people employed? Where is the action? Which is the fintech center on the planet that we should be looking at? So that's the question today. And we have a fantastic team joining us from around the world. Joining us in the U.S. corner is Matt Harris from Bain. Say hello, Matt. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Pascal Bouvier from Route 66. Welcome.
Hello, everyone. Very glad to be here, too.
Very good. And over in London, we have Uday Goyal from the Anthemis Group.
Pleasure to join everyone. Nice to see you.
And Uday, you've now got a new fund that you're working with as well. What's that called?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're looking now more as fintech spreads around the world into Africa and South Asia and Asia in general. So we're starting to look at financial services in those countries. And the fund's called APIS, APIS, which means B. So if anybody wants to check it out, you can just Google that and I'm sure it'll come up.
Very cool, very cool. And Claire Cockerton from Invest Finance in the UK, welcome.
Thanks very much. Innovate Finance, Brett.
Oh, sorry.
Innovate Finance.
Oh, my goodness.
It's all right. See, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm just coming back after a few days off with the dreaded leg. It wasn't Ebola. Everyone can relax. Although when I did go into the doctor in Connecticut, they did insist on testing me for Ebola. It's so weird. It's like I don't have a fever. I don't have flu-like symptoms. Anyway. Now the election's gone, of course. I think the midterms elections are gone. I don't think we're going to hear about Ebola again, but anyway. So let's get to it. So let's start off. First of all, I'll get the New York team to start off and let's put the case forward. Maybe Matt, you can jump in at the start. What makes New York and, so-called Silicon Alley a great place for, a core of investment in fintech, whether it's globally or here in the U.S.?
Well, I think you'd have to start with the presence of the bulk of the world's financial institutions' headquarters. Now, obviously, all of these firms have a distributed workforce, and they've got technology workers everywhere, and front, back, and middle office workers everywhere. But one of the things you find is that the location of the headquarters, as goes the head, so goes the rest of the body. By analogy, I'll say the reason Silicon Valley has remained so dominant in technology overall is because they've got so many headquarters there, from, you know, Oracle and HP, straight through now to Facebook, Twitter, Google, et cetera. And I think by analogy on the financial services side, you know, regardless of a distributed workforce, you know, as has Hewlett-Packard, Google, Twitter, et cetera, so too do the financial services firms, but their heads are here in New York, and that talent and that connectivity makes this a good ecosystem to start companies and build companies.
Absolutely. And Pascal, and do you think this is reflective in terms of skill sets, you know, hiring the right people to work in fintech? Do we need to sort of see that marriage between, you know, sort of those developer skill sets and technologies and those with real world, you know, financial services experience? Is that why New York makes sense?
Well, you know, when you talk about intellectual capital in New York, it's difficult to beat that. And you have to think more than financial or technology or fintech, and that helps the fintech sphere. You know, New York is a leader in fashion, media, advertising, some new technologies. You know, so you have that melding of all of that intellectual capital, whether it's technology or otherwise. Very, very difficult to beat that, especially when you know. As Matt mentioned, you have all of these financial institutions. New York is the number one financial center in the Western world. And you know, the goal and the end goal of fintech is indeed to marry and have a right mix between the financial side and the technology side. So, yeah, I would agree.
Absolutely.
Big leg up from a competitive point of view.
For those of you that are just joining us, we are talking fintech. It's the fintech showdown between New York and London. Who is the, what is the, you know, which city is the dominant fintech capital of the world? We're also just being joined by David Rose from New York Angels. David, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Greetings. Thank you, Brett.
So we kicked off before before you joined us, but you know, we sort of have to start at the required time. But having been really at the heart of this in terms of being the founder, emeritus chairman of New York Angels with Gust and so forth, you've been in the startup of the fintech space here, and you know, the venture space in New York. What makes New York attractive from a venture perspective these days?
Well, I mean, New York is the fastest growing technology startup ecosystem in the world right now. In terms of pure size, it's second only to Northern California. But in terms of velocity, it's growing faster. The city is, from almost a standing start in the last decade or so, has literally exploded as the place to be, and for a very good reason. Originally, technology and startups and all this entrepreneurial stuff we think about was based on pure tech, chip fab plants and giant wet labs and so on. But then with the introduction of the internet and globalization of everything, it turned out you didn't need to have a giant plant to build this stuff. You were now seeing technology affecting everything. And New York has historically been the center of finance. And so now it's the center of fintech.
Yeah, well, let's see what our London folks have to say about that. So let's now ask Claire. Claire, the UK has recently, particularly the UK government, has made a real play into the space, determined to make London a attractive hub. What would you say the advantages London offers, you know, against the New York is in respect to being a player in fintech?
Sure. They have devoted a lot of attention to the fintech scene recently over the last couple of years. And the stakeholders are coming together now to make it a global epicenter. I think we have no shortage of financial services might in London as well. Obviously, we have many of the world's largest banks located there and have 8 new challenger banks to the UK coming this year, as well as a number of new alternative finance players in the scene. So it seems to be quite sticky for several reasons. And I think it's sticky because We have a great talent pool there, world-leading universities. We're well-positioned geographically to access European talent and to trade with the East and West. I think we are also cultivating a well-paid developer community in London, and they are turning their attentions to fintech companies more and more. I think,
No, I do want to get into this I don't want to get into this resourcing issue with David and Matt in a moment, but maybe Uday, but given that you've got a pan-European view and you're invested in organizations outside of the UK and Germany and elsewhere, do you think that the EU and the ability for, to sort of get these resources coming in from other parts of the EU into London gives London an advantage from a resourcing perspective?
I actually think, Brett, it's a lot broader than that. I mean, I have to start and say that I'm in disagreement with a lot of the stuff that's been said earlier around. Firstly, I think there was a mention that New York is the global financial center. New York was the global financial center. That was probably about 10 years ago. London has an amazing position in the world because of its geographical location. It sits right in between the United States and indeed Asia. And everywhere in the world. In fact, there's only one country in the world you cannot fly to direct from London, and that's Australia. And that's only a matter of time before technology catches up and you'll be able to do that.
So, who would want to go to Australia?
Yeah, who would?
Just checking.
The surfing.
But I think that what's happened very quickly is that as a result of the global financial crisis, a lot of the U.S. institutions have become very inward-looking and very much focused on their domestic markets or their domestic market, which is the United States, whereas international institutions who tend to be headquartered out of London are very much outward-facing and are looking at new growth markets. And as you know, and there are about 2.5 billion people who are unbanked or underbanked in both Asia and Africa that are basically ripe for a product, and those products are starting to develop, and many of those startups are coming from London. So I would say that, yes, I mean, you've got to look at the market and what's your market size. And of course, the US market is an incredibly large market, an incredibly interesting market. But if you take a 10 to 15 year view, I'm a real believer that a lot of those companies are going to come from the international sphere and are going to ultimately end up in London. That's one point. And just very quickly on my second point, which is around the regulatory. So nobody's really touched on regulation and the regulatory area. And regulation is so important in financial services. I mean, this is basically one of the key areas that people think about as they open start companies. And yes, the U.S. has been progressive, and we've had great dealings with the CFPB, who launched Project Catalyst and did a lot. But, you know, I was with Martin Wheatley last week. We were on a panel together. He's the CEO of the FCA, which is the main regulator in the United Kingdom. And the level of progression that the FCA is showing in embracing early stage companies and helping them clear regulatory barriers, becoming more competitive, is incredible. And I'm actually pleasantly surprised. We spent, and actually Claire has been involved with this with me as well, have spent a lot of time with the Prime Minister's office in the UK, you know, pushing very hard to create the kind of regulatory environment which is finally coming to fruition. And I think this is a fantastic place. And I don't think the US is anywhere near. I mean, it's interesting. They were much further in front a few months ago, but suddenly they are miles behind.
Let's ask David, to sort of push back on this.
So first of all, I actually agree with a lot of what Ed has been saying, not about the overall supremacy, but the fact that the world is changing and that what you're seeing is outside of Western Europe and outside of the States, there is an enormous world out there of the unbanked world, and you're seeing lots of companies. There's a company, Lendo here in New York, Jeff Stewart's company, that's doing amazing stuff, with the unbanked and mobile banking. But it makes for great radio shows to have have, you know, the showdown of London versus New York. But in reality, I think what you're looking at here is these are unquestionably the two financial capitals of the world. And so, for example, and the UK, as it pointed out, and Claire pointed out, is doing an enormous amount to proactively make that true for London. And as a matter of fact, the UKTI, UK Trade Industry, set up something called the Great Tech Awards, designed to find companies in New York that should be expanding into Europe and make London their home. And I'm delighted that in terms of fintech, they picked my company, Gust. And so Gust won the first Great Tech Fintech Award, and we have therefore opened our office in London. So you're looking at a sort of, you know, bilateral citizen over here, right? So we're in New York, but our UK, our European headquarters is in London, and we love it.
Yeah, so and maybe
Claire, you go. Claire, you go first, and then we'll go to Pascal. And then I've got a question for Matt.
Awesome, thanks. Sorry.
So just keep it brief, Claire.
Yeah, the recent winner, Seedinvest, also came to London, and I think to build on the regulatory point, the UK has led in setting forward-looking regulation changes, like the equity-based crowdfunding models, to enable that to happen. And U.S. companies like Cedars came specifically to the U.K. because of the complexity of the environment in the U.S., the cost of setting up business there, and the fact that they weren't able to bring their new business models like equity-based crowdfunding to market.
Okay, Pascal?
Yeah, just responding directly to what Uday was saying. You know, much like I do not believe that unicorns exist, I also do not believe that the regulatory sphere is the catalyst or the main catalyst to spur innovation, whether it's in fintech or other industries. So, you know, you start with entrepreneurial spirit. You start with an entrepreneurial ecosystem, being close to customers, whether they're B2B or B2C driven, and with either one time zone or with one language that is spoken in their home market. And you always add up to the conclusion that that New York has a leg up as opposed to whether it's London or other capitals in Europe.
I think we all agree that the fact that New York and London are getting so focused on fintech and there's so much investment is just great for fintech. I don't think anyone's going to disagree with that. But Matt, one thing I will observe is that the venture capital guys we meet in Silicon Valley and the guys we meet in Silicon Valley, the Silicon Valley guys are very focused on consumer stuff that happens in the U.S., and the Silicon Valley guys are also very focused on the U.S. market. Is that a downside to this, that the investors and venture capital firms tend to be quite U.S.-focused in New York?
Yeah, and I think Uday was getting at this. It's a self-criticism that many of us acknowledge. It is sort of the disease of having such a robust domestic market does distract you from the global opportunity. And there are reasons why, for instance, if you're starting a remittance company or a cross-border trade finance company, there are indigenous advantages to being in London across regulatory as well as talent and ecosystem reasons around those two cross-border segments that you won't find surely in Silicon Valley and even and less so in New York than in London. But I will just return to the fact that there are seeds of success in London and there are great reasons to be there. And look, I played rugby in college. I'm a big fan. I go over whenever I can. But the numbers are pretty clear that New York is many multiples of London in terms of current activity. And so while globalization and more liberal, you know, regulatory environment, those are very promising. But as of yet, they're largely just promises.
All right. Well, look, let's break there. I'd like to come back and sort of talk about, what's going to happen over the next 5 years and what's, where the growth is going to come from. What are the key elements of that growth? We touched on that with some of the globalization stuff, but I'm sure Uday will have a view on that as well. All right. So you listen to Breaking Banks, guys. We're talking New York versus London, which is the global fintech destination of choice. We will be right back after this break on Breaking Banks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking, with features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance. Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here. And it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. We are talking fintech versus London, and we have a great lineup of guests on the show today. We have in New York Matt Harris, David Rose, and Pascal Bouvier calling in from Washington. And from London, we have Claire Cockerton. And normally in London, but today in Venice, is Uday Goyal. So thanks for joining us from Venice, Uday. So one thing I think we were talking during the break, guys, as a group, is that resourcing is key. One of the things that I've always been concerned about in the U.S. is this this political positioning on immigration recently has really limited the intake of H-1Bs. We tended to slow down. We know that during the 90s with Google and a lot of these companies were founded by guys who started out on these visas and you know, created incredible wealth and incredible innovation. Let me maybe, who wants to answer that from the New York, from the U.S. side?
I mean, this is David. I'll take a quick crack at it. I mean, I think there are two different issues here, right? One of them is the whole H-1B immigration question, and there's the entire industry is in the same position on this. Everybody thinks this is insane and has to be changed. And so, yes, this is a problem internationally, you know, in the U.S. particularly, I mean, across the entire country, and particularly in areas that are trying to be fast-moving ecosystems looking to recruit talent from around the world. So we are all in 100% violent agreement. Everybody on this program is that we need to fix that. That being said, it's not exactly like, you know, New York City is the Sahara Desert. You really have an extraordinary wealth of talent here, and what's amazing is how fast it's grown. I started my first tech company in New York City in 1983, and there you could whistle up and down Wall Street, and there was not a tech company to be had. Anybody who was doing anything remotely tech related was working for the big banks in sort of these giant, you know, factory rooms, right? On the other hand, talk about resources. On October 1st, just literally a month ago, Mayor de Blasio unveiled something called digital.nyc. And I would encourage all of your listeners to check it out on the web, literally digital.nyc. New York City is the first city in the world to have its own URL. And one of the very first sites on this is something designed to help resources for the entire city. It's the entire centerpiece of the whole community here. It's got every startup. It's got every job, every workspace, blog, event, video, a news story, tweet, resource, you name it, in one place. It's a proactive thing to help get resources to startups. And so far, it's been a smash hit.
Oh, okay. What about Matt and Pascal, from your experience as investors in startups based here, is resourcing an issue, getting tech, dev staff?
Yeah, New York City, you know, city center is expensive and competitive. You know, the only other place that's more expensive and more competitive is Silicon Valley. In my career, I worked in Silicon Valley, in New York, et cetera. I've also worked in a lot of secondary cities. In those secondary cities, things were less competitive and less expensive, and a hell of a lot less got done. And so in my view, you want to go where the competition is fiercest, because that's where the best stuff happens. That's where the very best people are drawn. And, you know, I talk to entrepreneurs a lot about this, and their point and my point is, yeah, it's hard, but the rewards are incredibly rich, and, you know, trying to do it in a backwater is harder in many, many other ways. So,
not that we're saying London is a backwater. However,
however, not at all. But I would say the presence of competition does create adversity, but it also creates greatness. I think that's true of New York and London. But it's something I've noticed in New York ramp up over the last 10 years. The level of competition for resources, and it's come right hand in hand with the level of success, and I think they're related.
Well, level of quality, what you get here. To put things in perspective, New York Tech Meetup, you know, Meetup, by the way, is a New York company, New York-based company, and the tech meetups are the fastest-growing parts of Meetup, and the New York Tech Meetup is not only the largest tech meetup in the world, it's the largest meetup of any kind. There are over 44,000 members in New York City of the New York Tech Meetup. I mean, we have a lot of resources here. It's very competitive because the better companies are doing it, and that's why companies like Movin and Gust and everybody else can get the top players in the field.
Yeah. Digital NYC tells us there's 5,922 startups in New York.
Those are actually ones that currently have public profiles on the site. The database for that is Gust, and we've got over 15,000 here.
Right.
Yeah, I will also add that New York's gravitational pull is very difficult to resist for other cities in the Northeast. I view Boston and Philadelphia and D.C. where we're based. Even I'll go further, all the way to Atlanta, which is a payment hub, that are essentially, you know, one step lower than New York is, and where resources, to Matt's point, gravitate naturally. I mean, we live that with one of our portfolio companies that in the past 6 months has hired away a technology resource and financial resources from both Boston and Philadelphia, and that was done with relative ease, I have to admit. Granted, this is one data point. I suspect that there are many more examples.
Okay, so Claire, Uday, what are your thoughts?
Yeah,
what?
if I can paint the scene in London, we have hackathons just about every day all across the UK. We've got a fantastic Silicon Milk roundabout, which helps connect developers to startups. We're running a lot of coding clubs and short courses in London, developing very fast-paced talent to move into startups. And the rise of the Elite program and other types of courses are really helping develop that technical talent. But the main point about London's scene is it's really multidisciplinary. And I think we have a huge creative sector and great design expertise, which can enable our fintech companies to differentiate.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty important point. There are some big agencies in New York. We have, obviously McCann is here and Leo Burnett and others, Sapient Nitro and so forth. But London has an excellent creative bent from a digital perspective. They were well ahead of the curve on that stuff. So that user experience creativity thing, that's something that I think London might have the edge on. Uday, what are your thoughts in terms of the overall resourcing question?
So, I think at some level London suffers from one of the issues with the US suffers, which is this H-1B visa issue has somewhat been replicated, unfortunately, in London because of politics and the right wing coming up. But, I think things are getting soft. But that being said, I would say that you have to remember that the London is within the European Union. And there is the free movement of people and capital across the European Union. So the market is a lot bigger than just the United Kingdom. And even if you look at companies like TransferWise or Transfer2, or, TransferWise has basically, a Skype founder who has moved from where he originally was, which, if I remember correctly, is Latvia, to London. It's headquartered in London. There are multiple financial services companies like TransferWise and Transfer2 and others where actually the founders are from all over Europe. And so the catchment area is so much bigger. And so what I would say is to you is that there is a very large, deep pool of resources that come from very tech-savvy countries like Estonia, Finland, and other places that are all, for whatever reason, coagulating in London and showing up there and starting their companies in London because London seems to be the right place.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Uday is absolutely right, and that is one of the great advantages in London. That's why our European headquarters is in London. But I would note that you were talking about resources, particularly tech resources and coding resources. There are effectively three places that they come from. One of which is the indigenous population. I mean, how many coders are sitting on the already in the location? And that was one of the problems New York had when we started out. I mean, when I started my first software company here, there was no such thing as floating programmers. If there were a dozen web programmers around, that would be a lot. But now, of course, New York has an enormous population of coders. The second is the naturally generated population from the existing universities. Both London and New York have amazing educational institutions. They are the respective centers of their country's educational systems. I mean, New York City has more college students than Boston has people, to put things in perspective. So you have that there with whether it's Columbia or NYU or Pace or right across the river in Stevens, you've got tons of tech stuff going on. And then the third thing that you've seen is, as Claire pointed out, this unbelievable emergence of purpose-built coding, whether it's coding dojos or Code Academy, or whether you're looking at General Assembly, which started here, of course, in New York and is moving now around the world, or Flatiron School, or a host of organizations that are spewing out really, really well-trained people in a very fast and dedicated manner, which is great for both of us.
So a little tweet out from Ron Shevlin, who's going to be on the show later today. He said, for somebody defending London, I don't hear much of an English accent, Claire Cockerton. So.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I'm half Canadian and half British, so thanks very much.
But that's in London's favor, isn't it?
But remember, Canada's sorry, I was going to say Brett, Canada is part of the Commonwealth. So in effect, it's an extension, right?
And part of North America, too. So, you know.
I'm loved by everybody, really.
There you go. Canadians are such nice people. And Dave Birch had a question for you. I think probably, Claire, you're probably best to answer this, which is, do you think that the EU regulatory environment helps or hinders London's positioning as a fintech center in terms of context?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think it's in the process of being formed how we are going to be affected by EU regulation. I think London is very well positioned, UK is well positioned to influence and to set the bar about how we see these emerging businesses, how we're going to treat these emerging business models in the areas that we don't yet know about. So in the cryptocurrency space, for example, London is looking to lead the way and set standards for cryptocurrency companies and exchanges by the Chancellor launched this consultation. So we're going to try and continue to build on our legacy of setting forward-looking policies for alternative finance providers and for cryptocurrency companies. And we hope that we can play a real active part in that dialogue.
So maybe I throw this to the US guys as well. I mean, we've got this Apple Pay fiasco right now with merchant exchange, currency app, and saying they're not going to, you're not going to use Apple Pay in their stores and things like that. You know, you don't have any of that uncertainty typically in the EU because these standards get rolled out and adopted by everyone. But in the US, it's got to be this sort of consensus-led thing. Does the fact that the US is this pure capitalist environment in this sense give less uncertainty to startups than in, say, the EU, where those frameworks tend to be quite mature? Or is this part of the magic?
More or less uncertainty? You just said less. Do you mean more? Do you mean less?
Uncertainty. Sorry, more uncertainty.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that having a capitalist, Darwinian kind of, world here, it means what the rules are going in. And there's not going to be some super governmental body that's going to tell you what to do or how to do it. It really is, let the best product compete in the marketplace and win. And I think Apple Pay ultimately is going to win. And I think that, this is a setback. And sure, as I believe it was Churchill who said about democracy, it's the worst form of government there is, except for all the others, right? So I think you could say in some place the same thing about capitalism, which is, sort of pure unfettered capitalism, provided you have some, it's a social safety net at the bottom end. In terms of business, is a really tough, nasty system, but it's the best we have at actually getting stuff done.
Yeah, I would say,
Matt.
Brett. I'm gonna interject here. Unfortunately, I couldn't disagree more. I mean, what's happening with Apple Pay is a clear manifestation of somebody who has a market dominant position and who's using that market dominant position to try to force everybody else in the market into a position they don't want to be. The truth is, Apple has a very dominant position or a very reasonably dominant position in the smartphone market in the US and has used that position to force itself to get 15 basis points on every single retail transaction that's used through that for a hardware manufacturer.
But hang on a second. The US is 10 years behind on the EMV standard. If Apple didn't push this, they would still be arguing that we can't replace POS terminals because
I understand that, but I've never seen a hardware manufacturer manage to get part of the economics, which ultimately the consumer.
So why is that bad? Why is that bad?
Because the consumer is going to pay for it. So we are adding more.
Wait a minute. If consumers are buying iPhones and consumers are using Apple Pay, who are you to tell the consumers that that's not what they want to do?
That's what I say. The beauty of Europe is that Apple Pay will never be successful in Europe because actually the level of interchange in Europe is entirely regulated and there's no place for somebody like Apple to force their way in to take more money out of the consumers via the retailers.
Brett, however, what do you think on this? Come
well,
on,
well,
come
you
on,
know, look, I don't think at the end there's going to be a about interchange in Europe. I think it is in the US, and MCX is about interchange. But in Europe, the drive towards tokenization is going to be about fraud reduction, because we now know that a 16-digit card number is no longer securable, right? Under any circumstances. So we need to move to tokenization. That's going to be the push. The question is that Visa, MasterCard standard around HCE and tokenization going to get enough critical mass, or is something like Apple Pay going to sort of force a hand there?
Or Brett, it's like Zap in the UK, right, which is much cheaper and has tokenization built in.
Yeah, all right. Well, so Matt or Pascal, do you have a 30-second comment before we go to break?
Yeah, on Apple Pay specifically, a couple points. I mean, I think last time I checked, the iPhone share of the UK market was 31% compared to 40% in the US. So I don't think market dominance is the issue. I think the structure of payments compensation is different in the UK. I don't think Apple's in this for the 15 bips. They're in it to make their hardware more useful. They will strike different economic deals in the UK. I don't think it will take off there any more slowly than it will in the US.
I agree.
Okay, great. So listen, guys, this is a fantastic conversation, fantastic discussion. We're going to have a quick break. We're going to come back after the break, and let's talk about what happens over the next 5 to 10 years in terms of where this goes. And I'm sure you'll all agree, if you're listening in, this is great for fintech. Fintech is finally in our zone. So this is great news for all of us who have been following this space for a while. You're listening to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here. And it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790.
That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Brett King. I'm your host, and this is Breaking Banks. We are talking with David Rose, Matt Harris, and Pascal Bouvier from US, from New York and Washington, talking fintech based in New York, Silicon Alley. And the team representing Silicon Roundabout and EU generally is Uday Goyal and Claire Cockerton from Innovate Finance in the UK. So before the break, we were debating whether or not the regulatory environment of Europe is better for something like mobile payments versus the pure capitalist environment of the US, where Apple has been able to leverage their market dominance to sort of force the hand of the big banks. There was an article in FinExtra. I don't know whether you guys saw it, and it was the title of the article, I'm not going to be able to find it now. This is what normally happens. Was something like U.S. banks forced to pay a high price for cozying up to U.S. banks pay high price for cozying up to Apple Pay, and this was about the deal on the 15 basis points, commercial agreements that they have. Now, I commented on this in that article on FinExtra. I said, maybe the headline should read U.S. banks pay high price for being slow on EMV and mobile payments and having to outsource it to Apple. And I think that's, one of the things here is that in the EU with something like SEPA or Giro, which are some great technologies that help in terms of bank-to-bank payments ecosystems and things like that, you have a mandated standard that gets put in place and everyone says, all right, yep, we'll do that. And then in the US, if you tried that same approach based on sort of the state and federal system, then you would have 80% of the room sort of put up their hands and say, no way, we're not going to do something that the federal government mandates us. Let us choose our own way. And then you get Venmo and PayPal and Dwala and, all these other schemas coming about, and you don't actually end up with a standard. So maybe Matt, you can jump in here. When in talking about sort of survival of the fittest and what David called this sort of Darwinian atmosphere, is the fact that the U.S. tends to look for these rising stars to get commercial dominance as a method rather than sort of creating standards, whereas something like host card emulation and tokenization is actually a pretty positive standard. Is that a negative for the U.S. in terms of particularly in this space of fintech where interoperability and standards around security and identity have to be fairly clear?
I think that there are pros and cons, and I'll articulate what I mean. I think that for a young company, it is more of a meritocracy. You are not going to be made the winner by the stroke of a government pen or by fiat. You're going to be made the winner by winning. Dwala has an opportunity through strength of will, good execution, outstanding value proposition, what have you, to introduce real-time ACH, or they could fail, and it's largely up to them. I think by contrast, in the UK, the market moved more quickly to a better answer for customers. But if you were a startup that was, launching a competitive scheme, and again the powers that be decided they were going to zig when you were recommending zag, well, despite all your best work, you lost. So I like the meritocratic approach of letting the marketplace decide, but in a standards-based world, which the heterogeneity of payments requires, I think the UK and Europe in general might make more progress, as frankly they've demonstrated with things like EMV, because of the ability to legislate from above.
Yeah, I mean, US always argued it was about cost of replacement of POS versus fraud, and that sort of has come crashing down on the US this year, hasn't it, Uday? Right.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I don't actually believe that Dwala is ever going to be successful in the U.S. to create real-time ACH. And part of the reason is that real-time ACH for the banking community in the U.S. requires a massive investment, because the technology that currently in most of the banking sector, 98% of the banking sector in the U.S. has, is not able to cope with anything that's anything close to real-time ACH. Because that's STP, and STP is probably a decade far too far away for most U.S. institutions. And basically, they have a very strong lobby. And the way the U.S. works is that you pay a bunch of lobbyists in Washington who then lobby Congress, and nothing will ever get through. And that'll be the end of that. And, you know, it reminds me a little bit of Standard Oil and what Standard Oil was many, you know, many decades ago in the U.S. until the monopoly was broken up. And you sort of have these same dynamics. And so, unfortunately, I hate to say this, but, you know, the U.S. market, you know, revolves a little bit around, I would say, you know, interests or, you know, beneficial interests or whatever you may call it. And it's very, very hard for some of these things to get through, whereas Europe has been very different and has had a little bit more, you know, of an attack scenario, particularly from the people in the antitrust world.
So, David, let's get your last comment on this.
Okay.
And then
my last comment is you know, we're all futurists here in this panel, right?
Yeah.
And so if something, you know, can happen and should happen, it will happen. And so regulation, and this is a global thing, not just in the U.S., but regulation is a temporary roadblock. I mean, just because you have an existing system that's 30, 40 years old does not mean it's going to stay that way. Just because you have entrenched people, you know, look at the broadcast industry. This is all going to change. Banking is going to change. Broadcast is going to change because it has to change. And it will. The only question is when.
Yeah, I always make the point when I talk to banks about this, and they, you know, banks say, yeah, but the regulator is going to let it happen. I say, you know, regulators don't regulate consumer behavior, and that's what's going to change this industry, and it is changing.
Who would think that crowdfunding? Yeah. Who would have thought 5 years ago that crowdfunding would ever be allowed by the SEC? Ever?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so guys, let's be positive. Yeah. Let's look at the future now. 5 to 10 years out. How can London and New York work together to really manage this explosion of fintech growth and these, you know, $18 billion of investment we're going to see over the next couple of years? You know, how do we work together to make sure that, you know, this is a healthy new industry like Silicon Valley was, you know, back in the day? You know, how can we really, you know, work together to make sure fintech is overall positive on the global scene?
This is David. I think that, like with Gust, the first winner of the first Great Tech Award, and Seed Invest, our friends with whom we've partnered, the winner of this year's Tech Award, you're going to see companies in London setting up their U.S. operations in New York because it's the sister city. It's the other financial hub. And similarly for companies like us in New York, you'll see us doing our international base in London. So I think you're going to see a lot of companies with their primary offices in both places.
Yeah, and I think we need to support organizations like Innovate Finance and their sisters in the U.S. who are able to create an ecosystem to help companies come over to the respective marketplace, help companies export, and drive more investment into the firms who are ready for their growth. I think we've seen mass proliferation in both marketplaces, and now it's time for growth, for M&A, and to help these companies really get to the next stage where they're looking internationally to export their fintech innovations.
Pascal, you're in Washington. Is there something we can be doing to lobbying Washington to get fintech some more headspace?
Given that I'm a Frenchman in Washington, I'm not sure that I'm the best person to answer U.S. centric lobbying. But Uday and Claire mentioned this a couple of times earlier in the podcast, and you know, they mentioned the international markets and how London is best positioned compared to New York. Yeah, I'll concede one point on looking abroad, whether it's in East Africa or whether it's in Asia, and London may have a leg up here. And I noted that. So the city of London, I think, has started some type of cooperation with the with Singapore, that's very intriguing. I think that you know, when I look back 5, 10 years out, and I think New York, I think the Northeast, I would like more of these initiatives here in the U.S. so that you know, we make sure that we don't miss the next light, which is increasingly going to be international.
Yeah, instead of just thinking this is the best place in the world, which is sort of the U.S. default setting. Matt, you know, 2020, what does fintech look like in New York?
I think it's more atomized. I think what we're going to see is these large banks continue to get smaller, not bigger, and many of the functions they currently do being done by startups and venture funded or not. And so we're going to see a proliferation of firms doing things that used to fall under the purview of large financial institutions. That's going to be great for diversity of employment. It's going to be great for folks who invest in the space. And I dare say we'll see similar dynamics in London, and it'll be a rising tide for both cities.
Okay, so Uday, you've got 15 seconds.
Yeah, so I'm going to turn it around. I'm going to say very quickly, I think the greatest innovation in financial services is not going to come from London and New York at all. It's going to come from Africa, and it's going to come from Asia, because people are going to find business models that are cheap enough to service those communities.
Yeah.
And that's where it's going to come from.
I think you're absolutely right. Guys, we've run out of time. David Rose, Matt Harris, Pascal Bouvier, Claire Cockett, and Uday Goyal, thanks for joining us on a fantastic show today. It was wonderful. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but we have a new segment up for you guys right now to close out the show. You might have heard something like this on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Here is Ron Shevlin with your moment of snark.
Of the many things that bankers worry about, the threat of non-banks getting into banking is usually at the top of the list. Now, playing on these fears, a leading consulting firm recently asked 3,800 North Americans how likely they would be to bank with a list of non-banks if those firms were to offer banking services. At the top of the list, Square, with 50% of consumers surveyed saying that they would bank with a company who has no physical presence, whose primary service, merchant acquisition and payment processing, is understood by no more than a handful of consumers, and whose consumer-facing product, its mobile wallet, was pulled from the Apple and Google app stores. The survey findings are even more incredulous considering that 2 years ago, less than 1 in 10 U.S. consumers had even heard of Square Wallet, according to ComScore. Now, my own research challenges this affinity for Square. Last year, I asked consumers how well they thought companies like Apple, Amazon, Google, and Square would do at providing mobile shopping apps. 8 of 10 said they didn't know how Square would do, and of those that did have an opinion, about a quarter thought Square would not do a good job. So, where do we stand? Few consumers understand Square's core business. Few know of its mobile wallet, which has been pulled off the market. And many consumers have no opinion on how well Square would do at providing things like mobile shopping apps. Yet we're supposed to believe that 50% of North Americans would be likely to bank with Square if it offered banking services. Yeah, right. Now look, I don't want to dismiss the opportunity that new companies have in providing new banking services if they focus on providing banking services. And I'm certainly not dismissing Square's prospects in payments. But if consumers were really that willing to bank with alternative providers like Square or Costco, don't you think these firms would have gotten into the market by now? After all, researchers have been conducting these studies for years, uncovering opportunities for non-banks to get into banking, opportunities that are unlikely to ever be realized. And that's this week's Moment of Snark on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.